We are now recording, and this is Out Now with Aaron and Abe. I am Aaron, and as always, this is...
Abe! Hello! How are you, Aaron?
Doing well enough. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for asking.
All right, glad we got that out of the way. Let's get to business. Out Now is a film podcast where Abe and I discuss new movies weekly. Mm-hmm. However, we like to have these special bonus episodes, whether it's one of our fun commentary tracks or something completely different. And this is a little different. It's another triple play because there are three movies that are out.
Touchdown! That's right, sport, right?
Mine was consistent throughout. It made sense and everything. And then you just like threw it in. You really smashed it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right on the shuttercock. But yeah, we got another triple play here. Yep. We're going to talk about three movies. This week we're going to talk about A House of Dynamite, Nouvelle Vague, and Hamnet. We want to get some extra reviews out there. We're spending time on these movies specifically because, hey, these are some notable filmmakers with some notable films, and why not have some deeper opinions on them? I think they're all worthy of discussion. You agree?
Sure. Yeah, I do. Nouvelle Vague.
Nouvelle Vague?
Yeah.
I'm going to stay vague anyway.
That's fine. Yeah, you're American.
Next, you're going to tell me, you know, I can't have my freedom fries anymore.
Mm-mm, yeah. Go play some baseball instead.
Do you play baseball in France?
Maybe, probably.
And probably in some capacity, right?
Yeah, but they're probably like despised doing
obviously,
it.
Obviously,
like, these Americans, they invented this game.
It's a football country. I understand that.
Yeah. With the accent over the U. Yeah,
what is like right. The big, let's see. I'm going to type this in.
I'm going to guess it's football. Yeah.
The biggest sport in France. I mean, like, obviously it's football, but, like, what else is popular there?
Rugby
makes cycling, obviously. There we go. Cycling.
Oh, like, we were just talking about
Tour de France, obviously, yeah. Happens there.
And, he won that in his dream.
Let's see. Tennis. Obviously, that makes a lot of sense. Tennis is really, tennis sure. Is very European in general, also. It's kind of, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's obviously become an American thing, also. But, like, tennis is, you know, it seems like it's one of those where, like, sports where you, like, dress up to go to them, that feels like a very European thing. You know what I mean?
Back when we used to fly in Pan Am?
But you know what I mean, though, right? Like, there's a certain kind of professionalism.
They do have, like, some kind of, like, dress code style.
There's kind of a prim and proper thing that goes along.
Especially if you're talking about, like, the Wimbledon. So,
yeah, like, there's a lot of matches.
They've got, like, the royal box where the royal family gets tickets.
Basketball and handball, also very popular.
Basketball, very big. You know, we talked about the French film, the San Antonio Spurs, a few weeks ago, where, you know, they've got Victor Wembanyama. So,
good callback.
Yeah. Oh, we do sports right here on the show. Yeah, that's right. Anyway.
What is Petanque?
Qu'est-ce que c'est?
It is a sport that falls in the category. Oh, it's like bocce ball. Okay.
That's another. Okay. That's another with your feet? Bocce ball. Oh, never mind.
Like bocce, so like throwing.
Okay. Yeah.
Similar sport to that. So that's another one that's in the top.
Retirement the top, home games?
It's in the top 10 of French. I forgot how we got this topic. We're like,
we were talking.
We're going to talk about like a Catherine Bigelow Furler in a second. Yeah, and we're like, let's talk about the sports of France.
Oh. Yeah. We're doing Sports Corner.
Oh, by the way, in all this, baseball has not come up whatsoever.
Nope.
It is not at all in anything I've seen.
They're not fans of the throwing sport.
There's volleyball, there's rugby, there's lacrosse, judo, ice hockey, canoeing, sailing, motorsports, but baseball is
all of these are Olympic events.
Nowhere mentioned whatsoever.
Now that you mentioned that, yeah, we haven't had an NFL France game. It's like NFL Europe, but it's like NFL in Britain or in Germany, but yeah, not in France. They
like in
don't.
Spain, they just played there like a couple weeks ago.
Oh, but they also have delicious food there too. I mean, France too. Yeah. Well, that was a Sports Corner.
Right, let's get back to it.
Back to this special episode.
All we're really doing this week is we're just talking about these three movies. So let's do it. Let's start with our first one, A House of Dynamite.
I always thought just being ready is the point. It keeps the villain in check. Keeps the world straight. They see how prepared we are. No one starts a nuclear war.
Approximately Approximately 3 minutes ago, we detected an ICBM over the Pacific. Current flight trajectory is consistent with impact somewhere in the continental United States.
Have we seen DEFCON 2 before?
No.
Is this real?
That should have been some of the trailer for A House of Dynamite. I'm going to read some pre-written plot descriptions here.
Hit it.
So don't mind if they sound more generic than when I do them myself. From Academy Award-winning director Catherine Bigelow, when a single unattributed missile is launched at the United States, a race begins to determine who is responsible and how to respond.
You should have done the In a World guy voice, you know, old 90s style trailers.
Well, it's late. That's true. You gotta really exercise.
Yeah, do it at 7 a.m. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So House of Dynamite. That's the basic plot, but we should note the film is told in non-chronological order. Basically, it's told in three parts, each part telling the same span of time story from a different perspective or different perspectives that kind of go deeper and deeper into the different estates and who's calling the shots and what kind of decisions are being made or whatnot. The film has a variety of actors, including Idris Elba, Rebecca Ferguson, Gabriel Basso, Jared Harris, Tracy Letts, Anthony Ramos, Moses Ingram, Jonah Howard King, Greta Lee, Jason Clarke. It's a long list.
Keep going.
Brian T., Brittany O'Grady, Menge Akagame.
People you might know is like Chris from The Wire.
Renee Elise Goldsberry as Michelle Obama.
Yeah.
Caitlin Dever. Caitlin Dever in a one scene performance.
Shows up in one scene and in a photo.
Angel Reese as herself. It's a whole list. I'm telling you, like, everybody's in this movie. We're in the background of one scene. We were like running and we're like, oh,
we're. Yeah, yeah.
We are the Civil War reenactment scene. It was weird.
We are on the right side of history, though, folks. Yeah.
That's not what your gray shirt said, but all right. It says, I have tea with General Lee. That's what your shirt said.
Tea with General Lee.
Yeah, that's what you said. You were proud of that shirt. You're like,
and I can't believe it in his face.
I can't believe I get to wear this. That's what you kept saying the whole night that we were there.
That guy, what a fucking loser.
I did it all of Stonewall Jackson. That's your other shirt that you had.
That was the overcoat.
All right, enough of the Abe is racist jokes.
I'm not!
Back to the serious movie that is A House of Dynamite. I want to know, so I watched this movie several weeks ago at this point. I assume you watched it just recently now, obviously.
Yeah, I did.
I want to know, what's your take on A House of Dynamite?
I think it was fine. Like, I think that when I was watching this, I was thinking to myself, wow, you know, Catherine Bigelow, a director that I respect and admire, and Zero Dark Thirty was like one of my top movies of 2013. 2014, I can't remember.
13,
yeah. And then, you know, Hurt Locker is pretty good. All of her filmography is quite small. She has less than 10 films, I believe. But all this to say is that I think it's okay. I think that there's an interesting idea at play here. I can see where some of the controversy kind of comes in with some of these folks that were saying, well, that was the ending. And to that, I say, you guys need to watch more movies, specifically like international movies, where they always have, or where they will more likely have sometimes an ambiguous ending. But my larger criticisms of this is that I was like, you know, there's just like, there is a narrative momentum that is here, but there's just not as much that sort of leaves me breathless to some degree. I was thinking to myself that this movie was done probably a little bit better with
Breathless. Good hint at the next movie.
With Crimson Tide, which is a Tony Scott film. And then, like, another director that I think would have possibly nailed this is Michael Bay, with just like the energy and freneticness that he has. In any case, I think it's fine. It moves, it's okay, but I think there are some actors that I think are highlighted much more than others, and I think sort of fit the billing a little bit better. My other criticism of this is that everybody is very handsome in this movie, and so it kind of distracts me to some point where I'm just like, oh, wow, you know, like that guy or that guy or that guy, and everyone just has a beautiful face. So, yeah, what did you think?
That last point, I didn't have a problem with the attractiveness of the cast. No, I guess
it's like that comment where I've made where some children, these child actors, I'm like, that kid's got iPad face, you know, where he's clearly seen an iPad and he's like playing like a 1990s character or something like that, or like his 50s character. So one of those situations.
I'm not trying to stress this, but who are you thinking of?
Almost everybody in this cast. Like, I think that Gabriel Basso is like, well, yeah, and Rebecca Ferguson. And then I think the Greta Lee is okay. Trixie Letts is actually one of my favorite characters in this movie, along with Idris and Jason Clarke. But there's just a lot of really good-looking folks in this movie. That's, you know, neither here nor there.
All right. I think at the movie's best, it's very thrilling. And, like, it puts you right in the moments as far as what it's trying to do. And that's never more apparent than the first act. The problem is there's two more acts that repeat the same thing again. And while they can be thrilling in moments, as far as listening to these conversations play out the way that they are and trying to hear and be in on the idea of trying to figure out what the best course of action will be, or trying to make sense of who has the best handle on the situation, I think those are handled in moments that are very, very effective. I think the problem is, as I've already said, you're doing it three times in a row, and I think it gets lesser every time it goes, it like resets the clock and lets you go through this thing again. The positives come from a casting perspective to a point, as far as you have just established good actors doing the job. So given a rushed schedule like this, where you're literally dealing with 30 minutes of time, it's not like I'm going to have to, you know, sit here and be like, let me get character development for Rebecca Ferguson and Jared Harris and Dante Ramos. No, there's no reason to do anything else beyond just put these people in a moment. So that's, you know, that's why you cast these people that you can rely on to be competent in what their job is. You can look at Jason Clarke or Greta Lee and be like, yeah, all right, they're, you know, these people, that's their job. Right. This is the thing they do. I don't need to like have further information to understand what they're doing. You mentioned Crimson Tide, and like Crimson Tide, there's certainly an intensity there as far as what's the message being thrown at you versus what's going on. There's obvious classics like Failsafe or 7 Days of May, sure, which are very much Cold War era movies,
yeah, dealing
with
exactly
nuclear strikes that deal with the
what was the second one that you mentioned? Failsafe and what?
7 Days in May.
There's
a lot of films like that just kind of deal with like the possible at the time inevitability of a nuclear strike going off and, you know, causing some kind of, you know, basically apocalypse of the world. You mentioned Michael Bay. The problem with Michael Bay is there would be a conclusion to this movie that's very there'd be no subtlety. That'd be my issue.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, it's a bit more of just like the pace of, you know, or making you feel as though like, well, this is a pretty serious and heavy situation type of thing. And Catherine Bigelow does a good job of that too, though. But
for sure, I think she does a fantastic job.
There were parts where like, yeah, I am tense.
As far as creating tension, I think she does a fantastic job. Yeah. That's like that's what this movie's trying to be. Zero Dark Thirty specifically, it's not the fact that it's not necessarily trying to be apolitical, but it's certainly not like it's not going out of its way to hold your hand and say this is how you're supposed to feel about this.
Right.
It's just presenting it in front of you and letting you do the work, which is.
I would also argue that Zero Dark Thirty, like the script is quite riveting in itself too. People are just like, well, there's not enough like manhunt stuff going on. It's like, no, the manhunt is like the CIA doing all this stuff in the back end. Like, and then the action part, you know, the last 45 minutes of it is action heavy, but like it is quite fascinating, thrilling, like worrying. So in any case,
it's payoff to something that's been done. I mean, Zero Dark Thirty is like top three for her, for me. Like that is her top of her game, accomplishing a lot and doing it really, really well, and having a central focus with Jessica Chastain. Where this movie, it's probably middle back end for her filmography, for me, as far as it doesn't have this kind of central focus because of the nature of the story. And I can admire trying to do something interesting with that. The problem is just, it's not as effective as it needs to be in all three parts. The first part, very effective. The second part has like bits where I think it really works. I think like Gabriel Basso, who's the night agent, of course, on Netflix, his whole deal of like having to like rush across a park and go through the security checkpoint and all this stuff while he's on the phone. On the one hand, you could be like, just turn your camera off. But on the other hand, it's like, this is actually really thrilling to watch this guy like go through all this stuff and try to make big decisions while like on a phone and trying to do things. Like there's stuff there that like works, and it helps that Tracy Letts is on the other side of that call.
Tracy Letts is amazing. Yeah.
The biggest issue I have, and I'm not trying to like weigh the film on this man's shoulders, but Idris Elba's been better, and I don't think he's good enough here as the president.
Tell us who he plays. Yeah,
he plays the president. And again, he's married to Renee Elise Goldsberry as Michelle Obama, and
not exactly, but okay.
It feels pretty one to, of all the people in this movie. That's the only one that feels like kind of one to one to me.
Difference of opinion. All right. But you're saying that he's stronger in other things.
I think he's been stronger in other things, including his accent work. It feels like he's like,
interesting.
Again, like people that watched The Wire didn't realize this man was British for a long time.
That was me. You're talking about me.
You're one of many people that didn't realize he was actually a British person.
Yeah.
So here it feels like, I'm not saying he's phoning it in or anything, but I do feel like he's not bringing it in a way that I think would have been more effective, given that he's the final part of this film. Mm-hmm. Like, if the second chapter was merely like fine, I was really hoping that okay. And I forgot or I didn't know that Idris Elba was going to be president. So I'm like, wait, who's the president again? So by the time I get to the third one, and it's like, okay, now we're dealing with the president, and it's President Idris Elba. I'm like, well, that should work out. And just watching him go through this, I know like the idea is he's supposed to be tired. And he really doesn't know what to do because, well, what do you do in this situation? But at the same time, whether it's a direction thing or his own choices or what, the power of what's been assigned to him didn't feel like it came to life in the right kind of way for me to appreciate the final section of this to make the ending more powerful.
Sure. So,
like, it felt like
– let me ask you,
I don't want to say a letdown, but it felt like I feel like this could have been stronger if it was handled a bit differently.
I feel like he'd have been stronger in some other aspects too. Let me ask you something. Do you know who Angel Reese is? Before this movie.
Yes.
Do you know what team she plays for?
That's since she left college, no.
Okay. Because I knew what team she played for and where the city setup is. I was like, is the president in Chicago? And like, oh, that'd be like a larger like conundrum, right? Where it's like, oh, well, he's in a space that could possibly be decimated by this ICBM nuclear warhead, and I was like, well, that adds stakes to the situation, but it's I guess Angel Reese, the real athlete, is just in a DC gym somewhere, so I guess that didn't really work out. But I echo your sentiment around the three acts sort of being the same thing, but just, you know, it's not even like a Rashomon situation where Rashomon is like, well, it's differently, like it's different this way. You know what I mean? And like, I viewed it as like, he said this thing. It's like,
yeah, it's
not really. Like, yeah. It's actually just the same stuff, just from the perspective of like a family person, or, you know, some guy who lost his wife and then he's having a hard time, you know, or like these soldiers in Alaska that realize that their first line of defense is maybe the only line of defense. Did not work out. So yeah, like it's this is actually where like the acting kind of comes in more so than anything else, which is like, if you're being carried by stronger actors, that will make a scene. Again, Jason Clarke being pretty subtle but also pretty good in his limited stuff that he's doing, whether it's just like being the boss, both in a bunker and also like in his regular office setting. So yeah, I would agree with you.
It's like, I know I just laid into Idris a lot, which I don't like doing because I love Idris. Idris is one of my favorite actors.
You hate Idris. You hate him.
I think he is a fantastic performer, but it's not that I don't think stronger acting like on an all-around level would have made this better. I do think it's a script thing as far as just the choice to do it this way. I don't know what nor do I need to solve it. It's just that the movie's what the movie is. I just didn't respond to it.
Is there like another? I mean, I know that you mentioned like 7 days and
in May and film.
Is there like another example for like? Well, you know, like it was actually more interesting if they did it in that script. I mean, we mentioned Rashomon, and what was the other political thriller with Matthew Fox? And there's like a shooting at some president.
I was just going to mention that movie. It's
I can't remember what it's
called. No, it starts with a V.
For Vendetta?
No.
Valiant Days. I don't know.
No, it's... It's, oh, for fuck's sake. It's
looking at
Vantage Point.
Vantage Point. Yeah, okay.
That movie also sucks. I mean, that's the problem. Like, the problem with these kind of movies is...
I don't think we liked it that much.
They're typically... It came out before we were doing this podcast. I mean, like, it was... Oh, yeah, sure. It's like 2008 or something like that.
Well,
It's... These movies typically aren't great when it's... Not just when it's, like, told for... But, like... It's just the same movie, but you're seeing it from different points of view.
Yeah.
They don't tend to work out that well because it's the same issue, right? You're
right.
You're resetting the drama without changing what the basic tension is. So you're just kind of playing a waiting game until you get to a conclusion. And what this movie doesn't help for some people is the fact that there's not even a conclusion to go with it. Like, that's... I don't have an issue with the ending in that manner. I was certainly taken aback when it occurred, when it happened. I was like, oh, okay.
I'm fine with it.
I wasn't like against it. It's just more like, oh, that's not.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I think
they came back full circle, basically.
I think the editing of that sequence could have been a little different as far as the final shots that we're seeing. Cause there's a lot of just people running around before it ends. Yeah. If you like really wanted to end on like Idris Elba like on the phone, like we're gonna do, and then it cuts the credits or something like that.
I mean, he looks directly down the barrel.
Yeah, but to get back to my point, like it's, I don't know what the solve necessarily is, or if even like movies like this just can really work, unless I don't know the script is just genius in some way, where something like a Rashomon, obviously, yes, that the point there is that you have different perspectives that are seeing wildly different things going on. I don't know how you do that with a movie like this where it's so precise about what it's trying to do as far as giving you a variety of different people in different locations at one time all responding to the same exact scenario. There's no room for, like, embellishment at that point. So, like,
yeah, and I'll add on to that, which is Churchillette gets one of the more interesting monologue dialogue parts where he's like, well, you know, if we're not really sure how this – missile was launched, then there probably could be a compromised threat internally, or something else happens, He actually lays out all the possible scenarios. But to your point, the script doesn't really follow up on really in any of those. And I think it would be a different movie if it did. I was like, oh, now we've got to find the mole and all this. Like, that's not really what this movie is about. This movie is more about like the things that when your back is against the wall, and I mean, the name of the movie is House of Dynamite. They reference it a lot in the film and the script itself too. But when your back is against the wall, like your morals will be tested, and you're basically alone in everything that you're trying to do. And you know, go with your conscience, kind of thing, as they said back in like the Cold War. But I also thought about Cold War movies during this viewing as well. And I think that the reason why those Cold War movies kind of work is when we were talking with Scott Mendelson a few weeks ago as well, we were talking about how the Red Scare and how it bleeds into art and movies and TV or what have you. It had a larger impact because there was like this real possible threat, you know, when you left the confines of a theater room or what have you. Whereas here it's like, well, they talk about a lot of different things that are on the plate, but I'm not really sure, you know, like, what would really be the situation in today's world for this? So it there's that part of it too, which is like,
yeah,
it's like it's a film script, and then there's also like the real life-ness of it. Just like, well, I think the president would probably know what his options are or her options are.
Well, I think to a degree, yes,
and sure,
it's a lot of speculation on our part as far as like
right.
But like, but
no, let's call him right now.
But the. I don't want to.
Idris Elba, though.
Okay, I like that better. The problem, which Scott was also bringing up, is compared to those other decades where you have presidents that you can represent in a certain way as far as even if you're not going to put up like Nixon or Reagan or Clinton or Bush specifically, you can put up counterparts that represent what like the basic line of that party was at the time, right? You can look at like The Rock, which features the president, but the president is just like a random white guy that seems even keeled and isn't like leaning on some specific side or whatnot. Or even Transformers has like a brief look at like an Obama or and Bush, because that's how long the Transformers movies have been around. But at this point, it's because our government is so fucking insane, it's like, well, you can't do a Trump parody because it's awkward to like kind of insert that into a movie.
Can I interject real quick?
Unless you're trying to very much go after Trump in some way,
either
for or against him.
Yeah. So when I was watching the movie doesn't have the president on the screen. And so when I was listening to the voice, I was like, is this supposed to be Donald Trump? Like, is this because it was speaking in like this like weird New York accent? But I was like, but he's saying smart things. And that's not really the same vibe that I get with this administration. So I was like, oh, well, is it or is it? And then when they finally showed the Oval Office, I was like, of course it's Idris with the voice. Yeah. But it confused me for a moment because, to your point, I was like, well, maybe if the president in this particular situation in this movie is lesser than and maybe less rational, mm-hmm. that would provide a different spark plug too. But that would have been like completely bad.
Yeah. But fortunately, the kinds of people involved in this situation feel like the kinds of people that even Trump hasn't like replaced for some kind of, you know, parody version of what that position should be filled.
100%. I totally am in agreement.
It has that going for it.
Yeah, I was like, these people are all too competent.
But yes, but again, like, that's how weird it is right now in America, where when we make movies that have to feature government officials, it's too telling to try to reflect today's actual reality. So you have to like go back, you know, a decade or so to like, let's just keep using that as our cinematic reality because it makes, frankly, more sense and is less laughable in what we have to like, unless it's a comedy to begin with or something like that. So it'd be like, you know, which is why it's like this is a neat film for Catherine Bigelow to go after, because yes, it's very like it's obviously less about like a resolve, because the only resolve, there's no like good version of what happens at the end of this movie, regardless of like what actually takes place. There's no version of that to be like, and that was the right choice. Definitely. Like there's no happy version, whatever
the ambiguity happens. Is actually part of, you know, what
for sure.
The ambiguity, interesting.
Exactly. But like you were getting at it as far as talking about the nature of all these people and like being tested on their levels of morality and strategically what they're, you know, behind, what they can get behind and how they conduct themselves under high pressure situations. That's the meat of this movie. That's where it's like the most thrilling, because you're watching basically competent people debating with each other what makes the most sense, which is can be fascinating to watch when it's presented well enough. And that's why I like this movie overall, because it does that quite a bit through it. You know, for a just under 2-hour movie, it does a good job of being like, okay, there's a lot of smart people in a room trying to talk something over. That's basically watching process in action with high stakes involved, and I like process. Right. So like that's fun.
And again, like where I think it's the best and meatiest is in those interactions with the geopolitical nature of things. The phone call with Russia was riveting. You know what I mean? Where it's like, hey, man, can you promise me that you guys were not the ones that did this? We can't promise you. It was like, but if you don't promise us, then we might have to attack you. And it's like, well, we don't want you to attack us, but we didn't do it. And then let me go back and talk to my president. Just a bunch of hangups, right?
And that's why I'm like, I can for one thing, people like this are kind of that age. They're like, they're younger people at this point that do some of these kind of positions that they're in. So I'm like, I could dig Gabriel Basso in this kind of role, watching him, you know, I'm happy seeing him here as opposed to as J.D. Vance. So he's got that
as possibly one of the killers in the Chapters movies.
In the Strangers movies.
The Strangers, yeah.
No, like I've seen this kid since he was a child in movies. So like watching him now being...
What was his origin story?
Well, he's in Super 8 for one thing, but...
He's that kid.
He's one of the Super 8 kids.
Yeah.
But he was on this show a lot before that. He was on a show with... actually, at the same time, I guess, The Big C with Laura Linney. He was her son in that show. So, like, he's been in, like, other things before that, too. But, like, he's a kid actor. So, like, seeing him now, because he's, like, 7'9" and, you know, like, 220, just all muscle. real specifications.
You're reading off of his IMDb sheet.
I'm not making that up.
His agent sent it over as notes.
7'9". but it's just seeing him be, like, in this position, like, all right, you're doing your job. I like the cut of this guy's job.
Sure.
I will say some of these are like way over the top. Like I like Jared Harris, but boy, did they like put him through like the ringer in this movie, as far as like he has this final conversation with his daughter, which is Caitlin Dever like doing Catherine Bigelow a favor. Just like, oh yeah, you want to like
you think so?
I mean, she's got one scene that's 5 minutes long. She was on
the set of The Last of Us season two.
Well, she was like, in Detroit. She was in Detroit, so like she's like, all right, yeah, I'll do my friend, Kathy a favor. let me walk out of a living room,
of a study room.
Let me walk out of the living room and get into the front door. I can do that. Get on the phone. Who am I talking to? Your dad. Okay, just say whatever. All right, me and my boyfriend. He's gonna get married. Thank you. Bye.
No, they're just seeing each other.
But Jared Harris, it's like, it's a lot to like look at.
It's
like
a lot.
He's being put through it. Like,
so let me ask you that question, which is, a lot of these characters kind of get either a side story or some sort of backstory. Did you think it was too much for the entirety of the movie, or did it work out for you?
I think the Jared Harris one's the only one that pushed me to a certain limit. Where I get how serious this is, but Jesus Christ.
And I won't name all of it, but, you know, like Anthony
Ramos,
gets a little bit of one.
I believed his. Like,
yeah,
his,
but there's like another guy in the same unit that also calls his mom. And then there's like a woman who's part of FEMA.
I'd argue that section I believed the most. The guys in Alaska, because of they're an age that, again, I think makes that's the kind of ages that you would have in those areas.
Sure. Yeah.
But they also would be people that presented with this kind of extreme situation, I can buy that they have to figure out ways to shutter their emotions and frankly just can't in some scenarios. Like, that's stuff I was like into, because like that felt real. That felt like real.
Sure, yeah. But I mean, like the backstory of like he might be going through a breakup kind of thing or whatever. So it's affecting his work. It's like, but it doesn't affect his work. He actually like keeps his head on.
He's competent. Like, yeah. The ones that bother me, like, you have Prince Eric from Little Mermaid, Jonah Howard King, who has the military.
That guy is.
Yeah.
He has the lieutenant or lieutenant commander. Or lieutenant
he has all the codes and stuff. He's Elba, and he keeps looking like shifty eyed the entire time. And I'm like, what's the what's the purpose of this? Like, why are we giving like red herring vibes to this guy all of a sudden? Like, can he just be a guy in the car? Like, I mean, like it's like played too loosely as far as. Okay. Like, what am I? This isn't 24. Actually, I'm not expecting like a presidential conspiracy to happen in the midst of this very realistic thriller. So it's like that. Sure. Or like, I didn't mind Greta Lee. Like, Greta Lee's fine. It's just, boy, did they really play up the fact that she's at a Civil War reenactment.
I'm on the same page with that part. The Greta Lee part was like, it actually isn't so much about where she is. It's actually what she says. She's like, it's my day off. You're talking to the president of the United States and you're like, it's my day off? I was like, what is happening here? So, I think it's trying to do a lot of things about trying to get one audience member or a few audience members to be on the side of one character or other characters to try and make it much more empathetic. And does it work? Sometimes, but mostly not for me.
I would say Rebecca Ferguson's stuff, completely fine. I think her stuff makes plenty of sense as far as how dedicated she is to what she's doing, what she eventually able to do with a very limited amount of time as far as communicating to the outside world, like all that stuff I think registers properly. That stuff hits. And of course, again, Tracy Letts rocks in this movie.
Just like, amazing.
I don't know how to describe it beyond just like there's a no nonsense to him, but like because he has sort of an inherent charisma, I'm not gonna say he's like the most fun character, but he's certainly like the one where when he talks, I listen in a way that feels acutely different than every other character.
Well, it also gives you a lot of his, you know, he loves baseball. And then he's just like, I'm going to go into serious mode. I actually thought that he was going to be on the TV screen for the whole movie. And like, oh, I'm glad that they've cut. Tracy Letts, phenomenal in this movie, I would say.
It sounds like neither of us have an issue with the ending as far as what it's doing.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of it, but there was like a film that I watched back in university days where it was about like a Sri Lankan like guerrilla fighter, and the movie basically is her debating whether she should wear the suicide vest to go and, you know, cause a ruckus kind of thing or start a movement. And the movie just ends on her putting the vest on, and then that's it. You know what I mean? It's like, you don't know if she does it or she doesn't. You've been given both avenues of her to explore of, you know, what is morally correct or what is not morally correct versus what is politically correct versus apolitically correct. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, like a lot of movies What I disliked the most in the discussions about this was, well, you know, you usually write this when you don't know what you're trying to do or what you're trying to accomplish. Like, no, that's not the case at all.
Like, that's what it was. Catherine Bigelow was like,
Academy Award winner Catherine Bigelow would be like, let me do this. And like,
I don't know how to end my movie. Netflix, please give me money anyway. That's how I write scripts.
So that I was like, go watch more movies.
And so this person's mind, she duped Netflix into saying, because she apparently said something along the lines of, I'll figure it out. Don't worry. And then she turned the movie and it's like,
we'll talk about the next movie.
I never figured it out, but you know, we still got a movie here. Wink. And like, yeah. That's how movies get made apparently.
Right. Yeah. So I was like, no, like directors think about this all the time. It is an artistic choice, and writers too. And it sometimes works out and sometimes doesn't. But just, like, as an audience member, you should probably be more or less like trying to view it from their point of view as like an artist kind of thing versus like, well, you know, that didn't fit with like what I wanted it to end. It's like,
well, that's what it comes down to. There's a sort of a selfishness as far as how certain folks believe movies should end because that's what they're expecting or whatnot, which is like, well, for one thing, you should want to be surprised by movies. But like the nature of what people seem to want is the same. It'd be like wanting Oppenheimer to end with, you know, him being like, and that's why nukes are bad. Like the end, like just like him stating the
thesis. that would have veered. I mean, from the real person himself and the book. But yeah, I know what you mean.
Comparatively, I mean, that's what I was talking about with the movie Nuremberg a few weeks ago. The problem, the main issue I have with that movie is it just shouts at you the message as far as like, and that's why it's similar to today. The end. Rami Malek. Yeah.
Oh, Rami Malek gets a speech.
He's the one that does it. He's the one.
Oh, I thought it was going to be John. John, what's his face?
Slattery,
Mad Men. Yeah, John Slattery.
No, as I said, he's the best person in the movie. No, but Malik is like just unfortunately given like just reams of dialogue at the end of the film that just explain the entire like message. I'm like, it's not hard to determine like what's going on here, guys. But this movie by comparison is much better in that way as far as, yeah, the messaging it's going for is clear without having to, like, rub your face in it. And it's abrupt in a way that, I mean, for a film like this, should be, like, shocking to a degree. Like, it's about a fucking nuclear bomb potentially going off.
Yeah.
The ending should be disruptive, I guess, to, like, the way that you're expecting it to be. Yeah. The way that the force of the actual bomb would be.
Correct. Yeah, I think that is the largest. That's the largest motivator, largest crux of why, you know, these actors or these characters are behaving the way they behave is because it's a nuclear warhead that is going to hit a major U.S. city, and the inevitability of it actually hitting the U.S. city is quite high. And so, if you're thinking to yourself like, well, you know, like I wouldn't have freaked out the way that like. Anthony Ramos' character freaks out, or I wouldn't have freaked out the way that Jared Harris' character. It's like, you're missing what they just said in the movie, which is like 10 million people could be dead, plus another 10% more. And I was like, this is a huge catastrophic loss. So there's a lot of stuff at play. I think what you and I are also getting at is it doesn't really explore or doesn't really hammer home that as much, per se.
Yeah.
But you liked it.
Overall, like, yeah, I think, again, at its best, like, it's thrilling to watch. Like, it's hard. I can't, like, picture a version of watching this movie and me not being, like, caught up in what's going on because it's presenting it. Like, it's designed to, that's what Bigelow's able, she's a good action director. And this movie's not an action movie, but it's certainly an active movie as far as it currently, it has characters constantly talking, going over every single thing or what. Like, there's no space to breathe because the movie's literally set with a very, very clearly high stakes and gives you a very limited amount of time for every character to process those stakes. Mm-hmm. So in the moment, I am caught up with what this movie's presenting to me. It's only like after the fact, or even like kind of during, as far as the effect it's having based on resetting the clock every 10 seconds, not 10 seconds, but every, you know, 30 minutes, where I can clearly understand that it's not like operating at its best as far as how I would judge the film, but in terms of my like having my attention and keeping me going, like, yeah, I'm into it. So like I think that's good enough for a director that I know is very capable of who's pulling off something with this. I just think there's obviously areas that I think could have been improved upon.
Sure.
Well, in that regard, the movie's currently streaming on Netflix. Which we will see this movie.
In our regular scale, if this had been a regular theatrical release, I probably still would have said streaming. We just said matinee.
I guess matinee, yeah. Because I'm a Bigelow fan, and watching this movie, I'd be like, yeah, I liked what Bigelow was doing here. Is in terms of trying something ambitious. I just wish it was stronger overall.
Sure.
So that equates to a matinee of it's worth watching. It's thrilling to watch, but it's just not as great as it could have been, perhaps. So.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on. Let's get to our next review for Nouvelle Vague.
Celui qui est au milieu, c'est Truffaut. À sa gauche, dans son Chabrol. Et celui avec les lunettes noires, c'est Jean-Luc Godard. C'est lui le vrai génie. Du moins, c'est ce qu'il te dira.
Moi, je suis prêt à réaliser. Maintenant.
Aujourd'hui, tout le monde adore la Nouvelle Vague.
That should have been the trailer for Nouvelle Vague. This is a 2025 comedy-drama film directed by Richard Linklater, starring Guillaume Marbeck as Jean-Luc Godard, Zoe Dutch as Gene Seberg, and Audrey Delin as Jean-Paul Belmondo. It follows the shooting of Breathless, one of the first features of the new wave era of French cinema in 1959. Abe, I'm going to go first.
Yes, please.
This is the second of two Linklater films this year, this month, in 2 weeks of each other, basically, with Blue Moon, the film with Ethan Hawke. And I already said on that, the podcast, we talked about that for a little bit. I wasn't a big fan of Blue Moon.
Yeah,
not for lack of trying. I think there's certainly plenty of things that I admire about Linklater films, and I wasn't big into the way they basically made Hawk into a very short person. It's a weird thing to criticize.
How tall is he in that movie?
Well, he's supposed to be five feet, five one, something like that. And Ethan Hawke is he's a tall man.
He's 5'11". Yeah.
I see the argument is but he's so bursting with life. He seems like a guy with Ethan Hawke energy, but at the same time, I don't know. There's something about the effect they're going for and the fact that it was very stagey. It just didn't work for me overall.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's worked on others. Just I wasn't big into it. So I was like, all right, let's see this other Linklater film. I want to see what Nouvelle Vague is all about. I'll see, Linklater has a lot of influences, but the French New Wave obviously is a big part of it as far as kind of his laid-back approach to things, non-traditional ideas and certain stories like his Before trilogy and what have you. So what's his tribute to that era going to look like? And I will say I quite enjoyed this movie quite a bit. It's less about necessarily the performances or the story it's telling, more about the vibes. I enjoy just being along the ride of this film. I don't think it's ambitious to a point as far as it's shot in black and white. It's going over a very specific time in French cinematic history.
Specific film, too. A very influential specific film.
Which is a bold move for any filmmaker to make to it's like watching David Fincher redo Citizen Kane, essentially. It's you're taking one of the big ones of cinematic history and doing it yourself in your own spin. So that can be a tricky proposal if you're not a very talented filmmaker. Fortunately, Richard Linklater is a very talented filmmaker. I will say I wouldn't call myself an expert on French New Wave. I've seen my share.
That's friend of the show, Adam Gentry.
Yeah, Adam. So he says. I'd love to hear his opinion on this film, actually.
I'd love to hear. We should pick him. We'll pick him later.
But so in saying that, I will say I wouldn't necessarily say I was lost watching this film, which is very heavy on name checking a lot of different
French filmmakers
of the French time,
heads, and
actors and actresses and producers and just people of note.
People of note, yeah.
Yeah. But Rossellini's
in here.
I didn't feel like I was being held back by not being an expert in all this stuff, because I think the film is smart enough to be here's a bunch of names. If you know them, you know them. But it's less about who they are specifically and what they did, with some exceptions for obvious reasons, and more about what was this scene like. What was it like to be a part of this era from Linklater's, his imagined perspective of all of this, and how do you communicate that in a way that for him reflects the sort of evolution that created this era of French cinema. So like on that level, I enjoyed this movie quite a bit. I was just like happy to go along this ride. I do think Zoe Dutch is quite good as Gene Seberg. I had a good time watching this movie. What'd you think?
This movie's a hoot. This movie All right. is a part of it is a passion project for a director that I think Richard Linklater has a lot of respect for and clearly takes a lot of influence from. I really love the parts where he's talking about where Jean-Luc Godard, played by Guillaume, is talking about how, look, man, art is just, it's in the moment. You can't really script it too much, and you can see it in Linklater stuff. Like you mentioned the Midnight Trilogy. Boyhood is like this 12-year like experimental type film. He's doing another one right now, which is going to be with Beanie Feldstein, and it's going to be released like 7 years from now. It's a long time, but I love the idea of just Richard Linklater making this movie about Jean-Luc Godard's Breathless, but then it's also about independent cinema as well. It's like, this is how independent movies are made, and like we're just like guerrilla style shooting this on the fly and just going for it and trying to get things. I went back and watched Breathless after this, like some parts of Breathless after this. It's amazing to pick up on the cues, like what you're talking about, where he was just like, hey, let's just shoot it this way and kind of like get some behind the scenes, quote unquote, of how they did things. Because there are a ton of just regular French citizens just looking at the cameras and seeing, you know, people acting on the streets and just being like, that's weird. But these are real faces doing real things. The editing style of it is very choice specific as well. But I love these performances from Guillaume, Zoe, among other people as well. But what I dug about it is like it basically breathes itself to life as you're continuing to watch this movie as well. The troupe really becomes this troupe ensemble, whether it's just them hanging out at the cafe and doing dances together and then trying to figure out what they're going to actually shoot that day or what the producer is going to say. And they just really become gelled. Like you can really start to see the change in Gene Seberg's disposition as the movie progresses as well, both with her castmates and also with the director. Big fan of like when they just start talking like the director, which is a bunch of idioms and quotes and things from like poets and authors, directors, what have you. But you mentioned Fincher, and I also thought about Mank as well. And, you know, when you have these folks that have such a rich appetite to try and find out more about these directors that they really enjoy, it's really fun to see how they interpret that stuff on the cinema screen. And so another director that I thought about while watching this is Wes Anderson.
Sure. Yeah.
While his pace is a little bit more frenetic, it certainly has the quirkiness. And also if you read about the behind the scenes stuff where he has everyone kind of live at this, you know, this actor village, like they kind of like all live in like the same area, all kind of hang out and kind of have like this bohemian style, like, you know, on set life. It's really, really like these guys embody the works of like the ideas of French New Wave. And so this movie itself, you know, like it could be a movie about making the movie, but it's also just this movie about praise and a movie about just a thank you to some degree. And it's so Linklater in what it's doing. And I found that to be fascinating. So it's a hoot because it's fun. It's charming. It's got a really good performances from almost everybody. Almost is kind of just more of like, well, some people are kind of jerks, or maybe like, you know, this one character, like to your point, I don't really know how they actually behave in real life. So I couldn't really tell, but it's just, a hoot in different ways.
Yeah. It's, you know, I'm always fascinated when directors also kind of direct outside their own, you know, country essentially,
and I mean, language,
you know, when they go international, essentially,
sure, yeah,
and to the point of yes, having a majority French cast, so you're like they're literally directing outside of their own, you know, familiar spot, and which again, credit to Zoe Dutch, who apparently speaks very good French, but she's playing Gene.
Yeah,
Seberg,
it's actually so pretty good. Yeah, I mean, like clearly American and clearly.
I mean, she's playing Gene Seberg. So
yeah, clearly, exactly. Gene Seberg kind of spoke it with like American accent. Yeah,
but I don't know the process of directing, obviously, because I'm not a director, to like understand every kind of thing that goes into it. But just the ambition that must be required from a director that's proven to have lots of ambition to be between the Boyhood project, the current Merrily We Go Wrong project, doing a trilogy of films over the course of, you know,
20 years.
Yeah. Like there's for a director who's really specialized in finding great ways to depict characters talking and hanging out, he's a really experimental filmmaker that goes out of his way to like do interesting things that no other directors are doing. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say, and now he directed people in French is like some kind of wild new barrier he's broken. But I do like the idea that Richard Linklater has been doing this since the early 90s and is not slowed down and wanted to accomplish, similar to like why I like Soderbergh, as far as these are not guys that are just like, we're used to doing this, we'll just bang it out when we feel like it, or we're, you know, on a, but like these guys, they're like, oh, okay, that's something I can do that I haven't done before. Let me embrace that and find a new way to approach it that no one's really done before. Mm-hmm. Soderbergh's doing that constantly, as far as just finding like,
he's doing that constantly, editing his own movies, like
his editing work,
wearing socks, using like Steadicams,
finding just new approaches to like old genre. Yeah. Linklater's like, I want to show these characters talking in a room. What's a different way I can do that I haven't done that before? And he keeps finding that in different projects that he's done, whether it's using rotoscope animation or being like, let's have the same characters have this discussion 7 years later. Like, that's nuts. So like this, comparatively, sure, not as like wildly crazy as far as the filmmaking goes, but there's just still something here about a director that wants to pay tribute to French New Wave of all things and do so in a way that feels authentic to the moment, as far as like he's shooting on film, he's shooting in black and white, he's doing this, that, and the other. And it's like you're saying, it's fun. Like this is a fun movie to watch. And also, if one of the many great takeaways, anyone that's like watched this film on Netflix at random and enjoyed it would likely be like, I gotta go watch Breathless right this second now. Which is like, why not? Like,
yes,
go watch one of the best films ever made. Like, I mean, it's just like, it's not a hard thing to do afterwards and realize that, hey, these French New Wave films aren't homework. They're actually very enjoyable and weird and different. Like, there's so much you can get out of watching the actual movies that this movie's paying tribute to.
And when you're speaking about, you know, watching Breathless right afterward, or people should go watch Breathless, it's fascinating how good Richard Linklater is at setting up the exact same shot and be like, this is exactly how I want you to move. Like, just watch Breathless and then we're going to shoot that, like that same sequence. The people are doing this. It's incredible just the amount of detail that he's just like, this is how we should, they gave us a blueprint, let's just follow the blueprint. But again, this is more about the behind the scenes stuff. They're having a really good time. I really enjoyed the aspects of Guillaume kind of being like, I love the way that this movie starts out. I think that it does start out a little bit, you know, coolish in terms of temperature. And then like,
You got to kind of warm into like what it is.
Exactly. You got to warm into it because if you're just seeing like four directors that you've probably heard of. And then they just watch the movie. And I love that he's like having this melancholy break of just like, I'm 28. I haven't even directed anything good yet. And like, yeah, but you made that one short film, right? He's like, yeah, but short film doesn't count as a real film. And so just like this really like hilarious discussion about film and my purpose and art. And when you look at it from that perspective, it's really cool to see how this kind of bleeds out with like even directors today and sort of, you know, what people might call like studio type directors versus like people that are actually trying to do things and do cool experimental things. What I love about this movie too is that if you love, you know, a Linklater, a Wes Anderson, a Fincher, or you know, Jean-Luc Godard, you can see their style, or you can see people that also want to try to break the mold in every country. You know, I think about like Wong Kar-wai, you know, or Edward Yang, or something like that, where it's like, movies don't have to adhere to a standard, you know what I mean? And when they do, they can become quite boring. But, you know, getting things in the spur of the moment, kind of like letting art being captured on film. I love one of the lines where he's like, hey, man, can you pay me for this? Like, probably not, but I guess I can give you immortality. It might be the next best thing. And I was like, that's a beautiful sentiment, you know what I mean? And it's true. He gave the actor who plays the lead actor in Breathless, it's like immortality, you know what I mean? So yeah, like there's a lot to really take away from here from both thematic perspectives of just how you should let art guide you, and don't be so, you should be open to it and let it happen at any given time and try not to force it. But also just a really like interesting crash course in directing.
It's funny you're just mentioning, you know, directors that have from all over the, you know, the world that have kind of taken inspirations and like find their own paths or whatnot. I'm about to see this film called Resurrection in a few weeks. That's from director Baigan.
Sound familiar?
It's like, it's one of the ones that's getting like a lot of notice right now. But it's from director Baigan. His previous film was called Long Day's Journey into Night, which is from 2018. Yeah. A film I really liked. Mm-hmm. And the crazy thing with that film is it's 2 hours and the last half suddenly becomes a extended one take that's in 3D. So like if you saw it in theaters, you'd be able to you'd put your glasses on essentially and watch the last half of the movie in 3D. And it's phenomenal. It's a great movie. And it's just the idea of a director being like, all right, now we're gonna have this new perspective take place that's gonna, you know, bring you into the mind of this character by way of this filmmaking technique. Yeah. And it's the most like, you know, it's not just a matter of, and now the camera is the point of view. It's, we're doing 3D, and it's not an action movie. It's not a horror movie. It's just a character drama. So like, it is great to just see directors that, you know, take the medium and want to do something with it.
Right.
And no matter what, no matter what kind of genre of filmmaker they are, you know, if
that's
you know, there's like a guy that wants to make a movie that like feels his drama would be enhanced because of this. That's just fascinating to me. So yes, watching Nouvelle Vague and watching Linklater once again, find a way to go from making films like Days of Confused to this and being like, yeah, I want to, you know, pay tribute to Jean-Luc Godard. Here's how I'm going to do it. Great. I'm all for it. I'm all for that.
Exactly.
And that he's, you know, probably gonna do something again like that next year. That's gonna be some, you know, something random.
I'm always down for a Linklater film. You know, like I think that he's one of our most fascinating directors. I you know, let me also caveat by saying a lot of directors take a lot of chances, and I think that I'm a big fan of like weird movies and stuff like that. But you know, like Terrence Malick might not do like weird movies per se, but he's got a lot of choices, right? Or something that you and I talked about last year, which is like I saw The TV Glow by Jane Schoenburn. Mm-hmm. It's like these are director choices, and if they don't fit with your vibe of it, then they don't fit. But at the same time, like at least they're trying something, and I respect that.
I'm about to see Hundreds of Beavers for like the sixth time in theaters.
It's being re-released,
tomorrow. And it's like, yeah, that's a filmmaker that's making very deliberate choices with lo-fi special effects, and yet it's more exciting than most of the things I see in a year. So it's got that going for it.
Yeah.
And as far as like directors that have embraced streaming goes, Rich Linklater's doing it. He has this, Apollo 10 and a Half, the animated space movie you wanted to make. Yep. Hitman, which was an acquisition technically, but still, and this, I mean, he's making quality work. He's embracing the today, for what it is. As far as if he wants to make films like this that are going to be straying outside the norm, that aren't going to get, you know, Universal money to go onto 3,000 screens and expect to make money, he's whatever concessions he has to make as far as being able to make the movies he wants to make, he's making them. So I can't fault him. Again, most of these are acquisitions so far. It's not like Netflix is like, hey, we're going to give you money to make a Jean-Luc Godard homage, but they still paid for it. You know,
I'm pretty sure if he had pitched that as his first movie that he's going to go out, they'd probably be like, choose something else.
Yeah.
But,
I mean, but they paid for this movie to come there, and it's not like, you know, I imagine there was maybe a small bidding war, but it's not. But you're not going to see like Warner Brothers. Boy, that's a bad choice today.
No,
you're not going to see you're not going to see Disney line up and say like, yes, we will put that out after Frozen 3. Yeah.
And I think that also speaks to a larger point, which is like sort of like the death of the movie studio. But that's for another day.
That's a different discussion. And yes, this is me trying to look at like the silver linings of things as opposed to the horrible, horrible news that is Netflix buying Warner Brothers today, which again is horrible. It's a bad thing.
Everyone's hoping that Tom Cruise jumps in and intervenes somehow. But Nouvelle Vague is it's very funny. I think that you mentioned that too. The way that this movie ends, like when they're screening it with his buddies, And then he's like, hey, man, like, this is a piece of shit. Yeah, but is it shit or is it, like, you know, loaded shit? And they're like, it's all shit, and it's going to get terrible reviews. And they're like, then it's fucking great. And I was like, this is so fun.
It's good. I had a lot of fun with this. I'm very happy this was a winner.
Did you get to see this in theaters?
No, unfortunately. I missed my chance to say I watched it today, actually. I've been so trying to catch up on all the things that I've been wanting to do. It had a limited run in theaters, and especially in LA, you get, you know, the 35mm screens run. I just didn't get to go to any of them.
And then
it's not like it's the end of the run for this. If they play it again somewhere, I'd be happy to go see it in theaters.
Yeah, I probably would agree. Yeah, if they release it for award eyes, I'd definitely go see this again. I think I missed my chance in the theaters as well.
Well, it's apparently playing on Netflix. When should people see this movie?
On our rating scale, I would tell people to go check this out in theaters.
Yeah, I would too. I think it's a very worthwhile film. And yes, if it was playing in the theater near you, I'd certainly go see it in the theater. All right. Well, let's move on. Let's get to our next and final film for this triptych, Hamnet.
The women in my family see things.
What do you see?
I see landscape. Oceans.
You're having twins, my girl.
Undiscovered countries. What do you wish to do, Hamlet?
I shall be one of father's players.
Will you be brave?
Yes.
Will you be brave?
Please! When shall we three meet again?
Our children's hearts beat. They smile. Play. Never forget for a moment.
Mama.
They may be gone.
Mama.
My boy.
He lives not.
That should have been some of the trailer for Hamnet. William Shakespeare and his wife Agnes celebrate the birth of their son Hamnet. However, when tragedy strikes and Hamnet dies at a young age, it inspires Shakespeare to write his timeless masterpiece, Hamlet. The film was directed by Chloe Zhao. It stars Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal. Abe.
Yes.
You're a Chloe Zhao fan.
I am a Chloe Zhao fan.
What did you think of Hamnet?
I think that Hamnet is a very moving movie. I enjoyed it quite a bit. I was quite devastated in parts of it, for sure. I think Jesse Buckley is incredible in this movie. Paul Mescal is very good, too. I would say all the actors are very good in it, but Jesse Buckley, far and ahead, is just like doing some incredible work here. I hope that they spent a lot of money on some sort of award run for her. Hamnet itself is it is devastating in it, but what I liked about it the most is sort of, we talked about it with Sentimental Value and a little bit with like Drive My Car, but like the value of art in grief, you know, and how you can really put yourself through, or you can really express more things through it. Whereas one parent is more openly grieving about the loss of their child, another might be like inwardly grieving, but just putting a lot of effort into some of their work so that it can speak for them and live throughout the testament of time kind of thing. Is it my favorite movie of the year? No. Is it like one top tens? Probably, or possibly. But at the same time, I did quite enjoy this for a lot of reasons, but primarily from the standpoint of like the story and Jesse Buckley kind of just like really carrying things. I enjoyed that the set design and production design kind of let things be sort of dirty, muddy, you know, like there's a lot of dirt and fingernails all the time, you know, nothing's very clean per se. So it's kind of more quote unquote realistic. There's a lot of literary elements in this movie, whether that be metaphors or things such as like a hawk and making wishes. But I think some of the cinematography really, really helps out to convey more parts of the story too, whether it be a boy alone in a field or, you know, shrouds of veils over a lens or what have you. But yeah, man, overall, I really enjoyed this movie.
Here's a fun bit of trivia. What's William Shakespeare's wife's real name?
I don't know.
It's Anne Hathaway.
But you can are you see, kidding or are you not kidding?
I'm not kidding. You can wow, see why okay. they, you know, maybe wanted to alter that to not
yeah
make things a little too like. Oh,
has anyone checked her attic to see if there's like a Dorian Gray situation? She's just eternally youthful, but the picture is taking up all of her age. Yeah.
Yeah, in the novel and the film, they've changed her name to Agnes Hathaway as opposed to the novel
By Maggie O'Farrell.
Who co-wrote the screenplay with Chloe Zhao. I agree with you on Jessie Buckley as far as she's very, very good in this movie. If I wasn't so team Rose Byrne, I'd say please hand her the Oscar, because I've been with Jessie Buckley for a long time. I think she's been a terrific actress who's come along fairly recently, but is just nonstop giving great performances. So, like, it's not surprising to me to see that she's this good here, but obviously she's very, very good here. Mm-hmm. I just really like that Rose Byrne performance. And
I still have to catch that one.
But, the cinematography you also mentioned, I think, is another highlight of this film. It's from Lucas Zal. Lucas Zal is responsible for films that I very much like. Ida, Cold War. I was already in the pocket when I saw his name pop up here.
Yeah.
He's also did, I'm thinking of Ending Things, which starred Jesse Buckley. And The Zone of Interest. Three of those he's been nominated
for. These are beautiful looking movies.
Three of those he's been nominated for Academy Awards for. So, like, presumably he's going to be in contention this year, and if he won, I'd be a little surprised, because there's a lot of competition this year, but I wouldn't be against it, because he's one of my guys, is what I'm saying.
Okay.
He is like Luke. I love Deakins, love a lot of these guys that do these things. Lucas Zal is a name that I think is one that really should have more going behind it when people like talk about great cinematographers, because I think he's really, really good. And this is him doing color for a change, as opposed to black and white.
Oh yeah.
Which he's been, you know, he's, it's not,
well, there was a little bit of color in the third act of that Nazi movie
Zone of Interest. And I'm thinking of anything. So, like, he's not, I'm not saying he hasn't done color before.
I know, it's just, it's more
in
general.
Terms of like these prestige films that are obviously getting best picture notices. This is one that's like, it's breaking away from what he's traditionally been nominated for. All of that said, I am not as big on this movie as I think, as you are. And I think the majority of people are, it's not for lack of trying. Obviously, this movie has very good things about it all the way through. There's great performances. It looks fantastic. The way the story is handled, I think, is interesting as far as presenting me like a new perspective on Hamlet that I just didn't know before, or at least wasn't, or at least this movie's, you know, so supposing. So I'm like, okay, cool. That's different. That's something else. The issue I have, and also, I would say I also appreciated that Chloe Zhao did something different for herself as far as the film goes. Like, you know, she's made, now it's not, it still like depends on certain character traits that are familiar that you can stretch across her different films, as well as like her take on the natural world and how she films that in relation to these characters. But in terms of, you know, you watched a cowboy drama and
Played by the real selves.
And, you know, a movie about a scavenger, essentially, you know, trying to figure half themselves real out.
Half people, half actors.
And then watching a Marvel superhero film, seeing her take on a literal Shakespearean drama. I can admire a director that's, like, really going out of their way to, like, make certain kinds of moves into different areas. So the issue I have with this movie, I think the emotion that it's going for is very telegraphed in a way that I couldn't get myself more behind it, because I felt like the film was doing too much work and not letting me experience enough myself.
Okay.
I think part of that comes from Max Richter's score, because the score
I want to talk about that. Yeah.
Is it good? Yes, but I think it's very much forcing me to feel as opposed to letting me do some of the feeling. And that especially comes with the end, because he uses that fucking track on the nature of daylight, which is in multiple movies and TV shows at this point.
Yeah.
And does this movie necessarily earn that track? Clearly others believe it has, because it's won so many audience awards.
It also disqualified him from an Academy Award for Arrival, right?
I believe so, yes. Okay. But now they've lightened up in recent years, and I believe
it's did they?
In recent years, they've changed things a little bit.
You can reuse your old work? Regardless, we'll find
depends.
Out.
We'll find out what happens with this year.
Yeah.
Regardless, I wanted to be won over more than I was by the end of this movie, which is obviously trying to be this kind of, you know, big revelation point that, you know, brings everybody together in a certain kind of way, or brings the emotion together, brings the audience together with the characters and whatnot.
Yeah.
And I just, I wasn't feeling it as much as I would have liked to. All this is me saying I do like this movie. I do think it's a worthwhile film, worth seeing, great performances, has a lot going for it. But I do think it's I don't think it's as strong as it could have been based on how hard it's wanting me. It's forcing me to want to appreciate it as opposed to.
You would have liked more subtlety.
I would have liked more subtlety.
Yeah.
I do think the end of this movie that's supposed to be very emotional, while I had issues with perhaps the song, music choice or what have you, I do think, again, Buckley is doing so much work.
Buckley's incredible in this.
And the little kid that plays Hamnet. Jacoby Jupe plays Hamnet.
Yes.
And then, yes, very cleverly, they have his older brother, Noah Jupe, play Hamlet on stage. I thought that was actually
Jacoby
nice.
Is very
but
good.
This kid, Jacoby, he's really good. And the fact that he's both here as Hamnet when he's alive, and then there's a little more of him afterwards, I'm like, this kid is it's the kind of thing that always fascinates me about like young person performances, as far as obviously they're smart enough to act, but like, I want to know how much they're like really emotionally registering and how much is just them being told like, walk over here and make this face. Whatever the combination of that is, he's pulling it off in a way that I really appreciate it, because there's,
I think all the child actors in this actually do a really good job.
Yeah.
His twin sister and also the older sister.
Like something I would say about Eternals, for example, is that the acting is not the issue of that movie. And that's a movie I think is fine. Like, I don't dislike Eternals, but it's not peak Marvel. I think we'd both agree on that.
I've kind of blocked a lot of it from my memory.
But the things I do remember about the movie is that I do like the ensemble and their performances in that film. I wish they were perhaps more memorable as characters, but in terms of like the performances I was getting from Camille and Brian Tyree Henry and Angelina Jolie, like, and Barry Keoghan, they're all solid.
Barry Keoghan's probably like the best arc in that movie.
They're all like the acting in that movie, which speaks to, I think Zhao is a good director of actors, what I'm saying. And I do think getting good acting out of performances out of children in a film like this, that can be very special. So it's like, there's plenty here to recommend. Again, I think this movie does, it works as far as doing at least the minimum to get you moving.
As you were talking about. Yeah, as you're talking about the movie, and we're talking about subtlety, a movie that kind of occurs to me is sort of similar in the same vein. I'd be curious your thoughts, because I think I remember is First Man, which is very much about the Damien Chazelle film, about people were thinking like it's supposed to be a space movie, and it ends up being this character drama piece about grief as well. And the end of that movie has Claire Foy kind of understanding that her husband is now back after he's had to go through this monumentous journey to deal with his feelings about his lost child as well.
Yeah, First Man was on my top 10 that year. And First Man, here's a fun way to put it, but First Man is like, let's do the Apollo moon landing movie, and everything that Michael Bay would do the opposite. That's what I think Damien Chazelle's approach to First Man was.
Yeah, totally understandable. I want to ask you about sort of the narratives that are sort of coming out of some of the critics' circles, which is this movie is emotionally manipulative.
Uh-huh.
Where are you on that?
I mean, yes, I would say so. That's my main issue.
In a negative way?
Not necessarily in a negative way, but more in a if the movie wants to bring me closer to it, I think there are better ways it could have gone about doing so rather than using a very manipulative score or laying on the drama in ways that it does that feel like there's no other way to engage with this film except by having sympathy for the characters to this extreme of a level. Now, granted, it's based on some level of reality, but at the same time, it's like, it's as if the movie feels like it's going to be boring if we don't throw in this in this way, and therefore let's really hammer it home with why Agnes is this depressed and why William Shakespeare has to go away and do his work and whatnot. It's really hitting me over the head with those reasons.
Understandable. At certain points in this movie, I thought it was going to be a little bit more. What's the word where it'd be? More like fantastical, like more of like a fantasy type setting, like green.
Oh, Yeah, like magical realism.
Magical realism, yeah. Because, you know, Agnes is a woman of the woods, and she's kind of like a woman of the earth. And there's a lot of, like, allegory of, like, you know, rivers overflowing and what have you. And so it kind of deals with that sometimes. It sometimes doesn't. But, you know, when it does, I'm quite fascinated and enthralled by it because it becomes quite literary. And it doesn't really stick with it all that much. But all this is that there's, like, some hits and misses. For sure.
I hear what you're saying, because I do think that, I mean, that's frankly just, it's not the movies. There's nothing really to judge there. But I do think I would have welcomed a sort of extra level of spirituality to come along Agnes's journey, if it meant less of Agnes's torment depicted in such a strong way. If anything, I think it's just like the middle act of this movie just kind of bogs me down in really sad stuff. And that's not to say that a drama can't do that, but if the approach to doing that means laying it thick with the music and with, you know, how dialed in these performances are to really leave me no room but just to be sad. I don't know how else to describe it beyond it just wasn't engaging me at the high sort of level that I have been by other dramas that are similar to something like this.
Yeah, Transformers: Revenge of the Fallen. Yeah,
Transformers: Revenge of the Fallen. Yeah. you know, The Hangover Part 3.
A goofy movie. An extremely
goofy movie.
Five Nights at Freddy's.
Five Nights at Freddy's 2, which we'll talk about on Sunday for a bit. You know, Double Dragon.
Everyone loves Matthew Fox. No, sorry, that's not Matthew Fox. It's the other party of five guys.
Scott Wolf. I like it. No, let's back this up for a second. He said Matthew Fox because I thought
it was an animal.
You got the wrong, like, generic white guy mixed with animal name. Yeah. He said Matthew Fox instead of Scott Wolf.
Right when I said Matthew Fox, I was like, well, they're both on Party of Five.
That's really funny.
Like 6'1", and the other one's like 5'6".
It's 5'6" is generous.
Really? Okay.
Yes. Anyway, back to our serious discussion of Hamnet. Paul Mescal is also, I think, like, I don't think he's bad in this movie. I like Paul Mescal well enough. Sure. I do think of the two of them, his William Shakespeare is like, he's really heavy. And he, like, to the point of he has to give, like, the whole to be or not to be speech, which is not badly done.
It's kind of fascinating to, like, the origin of it, perhaps, if it's real. But
yeah,
I hear what you're saying.
It feels, like, extreme.
I would also say that he doesn't really get ignited as much in the film until he's literally yelling at one of his actors.
Yeah.
About, like, hey, man, you're, like, you're doing this wrong. And there's supposed to be much more intentionality and emotion behind it. And I'm like, Paul Mescal, I think, is better in these types of films, though, where there are smaller, quieter dramas versus, like, a Gladiator 2, which I didn't think he was, like, that great in. But, you know, like, Normal People or After Sun or something like this, where he's just playing a guy. he excels in, like, these quiet, sad parts.
He's frankly just not in many movies so far. So, like,
that's true. Yeah, his filmography is smaller.
Yeah, because, like, I like him. He's in Gyllenhaal's first movie, The Lost Daughter, which I like quite a bit. And it's, like, a small role, but he plays, like, I think Dakota Johnson's, like, asshole husband, I believe, in that movie. I might be wrong. No worries.
Yeah, but at first I thought you were talking about Dakota Fanning, and I was like, "Wow, she's been in a lot of things." But yeah, Dakota Johnson, I get it.
Well, because now I'm thinking, as I tried to remember that movie,
now
because we have Olivia Colman, but then Jesse Buckley is in that movie also playing the younger version of Olivia Colman.
Wow.
I'm thinking, wait, is he her lover in the past? Like, oh, so they're reuniting now. Then I'm like remembering this movie. I just also remember that Dakota Johnson has an asshole husband. I remember that also, but I know.
When does she not have an asshole husband?
Yeah, she seems to have a lot of asshole husbands.
Yeah,
in movies.
I think. Yeah, she kind of reconciles with it in a lot of her films,
including Splitsville, which is hilarious, and I recommend that film very
much. Also, you know, like in Materialist, it was her boyfriend, but you know they were.
Neither of them were assholes in that movie. They're just like, you know,
one of them's just poor.
We're courting. We're seeing what's going to work out.
Yeah.
I will be curious. About
the Max Richter song, real quick.
Well, to finish up the Paul Mescal thing, he is going to be Paul McCartney in the Sam Mendes Beatles thing. That's
you know coming. who that cinematographer is? Greg Frazier. He left. He can't do Dune 3 because he's doing the Beatles movie.
Yeah.
Or he can't do the Batman 2. Sorry.
He can't do Batman 2 because he's doing Beatles.
He's doing Beatles. But the Nature of Daylight on Nature of Daylight, it just took me out of the movie because we've heard it before. Yes.
Yeah.
And I've seen it in a modern take, which is Arrival. And I think it really worked for me in Arrival because I had not heard it before. And it also is this really beautiful inter cross-sectional time story introduction to Arrival, and I was like, wow, this is very moving. And then seeing it here, I was like, it kind of takes me out of it because I have heard this piece before. And is it a good piece? Sure. But it has been used in many films, and yes, that's kind of why it has at least like five. I looked it up afterward. And it if it wasn't for Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal kind of doing their thing and Noah Jupe kind of doing his thing on the stage, I don't know if it really would have. I probably would have been like, I don't know, man, not my favorite. So that piece in itself, I was happy that the entire score was made by Mack Richter because I was thinking about awards.
He's a good composer. I mean, you know, no doubt.
And I was thinking about awards nominations. Like, well, they can't now. This can't be nominated, but we'll see. All this to say is that that particular piece, because I've heard it before, it kind of takes me out. And it's not as though I can't hear pieces and it keeps me in the movie. It's just that this one's very particular. It's always trying to ride on these, like, trying to make you feel these sad emotions.
It's the hallelujah of modern classical music. Like, it's just, you throw that song on there and it's like, yeah, there it's hallelujah. All
right. Right. It's just, I mean, worse than Shrek. The John Cale Hallelujah, which is very good. I brought up After Sun. After Sun uses a David Bowie song, Under Pressure, in a beautiful way, you know? And so, that's my gripe with On the Nature of Daylight in this film.
You know what I like about Under Pressure?
What's that?
The people on the streets.
Get up! I just want to mention very quickly that there are other characters in this movie too, including Emily Watson.
Emily Watson,
who kind of plays like William Shakespeare's mom. You're talking about the middle parts, like those middle parts featuring other characters took me out of this movie.
Yeah.
Echoing your point of like, I can understand why it doesn't work for everybody.
Yeah, I it's the kind of thing. And this is where
even Joe Alwyn, to some degree, I'm like, he doesn't really have a lot to do.
He's fine.
I like seeing him in things.
Yeah, it's more like, I hate when this becomes a thing, but like, you have movies that are so, you know, because they won the Toronto Audience Award and it's gained so much buzz and what have you. So obviously it's a big deal. And when that doesn't quite click for you in the way that it seems to have for like all the people that it was working for up till then, it's not annoying for me to feel that. Cause it's like, a movie doesn't work. That's not anybody else's fault. It's just how it is. However, it is hard to like it. It's frustrating to try to pick apart what it is that makes you feel like you're sitting yourself different from what others when the others don't really matter in the scheme of things. So I'm sitting here like, and I've watched Hamnet 2.5 times now at this point.
2.5? Wow.
Because I saw it in theaters or like at my screening, and then I got the screener for it, so I watched it, and then I watched like parts of it again to see like what is it that it's not like hitting me as hard as it could, so I can kind of like basically so I can do this podcast with you.
Sure.
And watching, and because that's how lucky I am, I can watch the movie whenever the fuck I want to. So,
you call up John Universal and you're like, get me the screening room over at Universal Campus, the big one. It's not even called Universal Campus. I forget what it's called. City Walk. Yeah. But I hear what you're saying, or at least you gave it a shot, you know, and this is how I felt last week when I was talking about Zootopia 2. It's like, I like it, but I didn't love it. And I think that, you know, there are reasons why I didn't love it where it just didn't hit me as much as
you just hate laughing. I get it.
I do. Yeah. I hate laughing. That sloth was like super annoying because he drives really fast. And yet, you know, like, how does he step on the brake if he's so slow? It would take him an hour to pump the brakes, but
it wouldn't take a very long time to pump the jams.
No, pump it up.
Yeah.
I do want to also just quickly throw in like one scene that I did enjoy quite a lot, which is quite lyrically literal and literative, which is the scene where Hamnet comes downstairs to check on his sister. And yeah. then there's a camera and the camera plays a character in the scene. I was like, this is some really good stuff that the director is trying to convey to you.
Yeah.
And emotionally it also works because of what he says, because he's echoing what his dad told him to do. But also like basically the sacrifice that makes like the ultimate sacrifice type situation, where it gets you like the free pass into heaven kind of thing. And it's like, this is a beautiful scene.
Agreed. I agree with all that. Again, plenty of good stuff in this movie.
Right.
I just
take Chloe Zhao and
it didn't resonate with
Paul
me.
And Paul Mescal.
It didn't resonate with me as much as I would have liked it.
Yeah.
But
understandable.
So obviously I'll be rooting against it when it comes to the Oscars.
you do have Rose Byrne for Best Actress.
I can't even root for the lead.
It's gonna be hard because if they're both crying, I don't know, man.
There's so many. It's funny. I was trying to make a tweet that was like ranking all of the women.
Do you still have it saved in drafts? Can I see it?
No, I don't anymore. Okay. But I'm going to say it right now, so it doesn't matter. But all the like lead movies of lead female performances where the women are in severe distress, usually based on pregnancy, and it's mm-hmm. but there ended up being too many. So I'm like, I can't even make this a tweet anymore because it's not going to fit because there's so many of that. But it's like between this and If I Had Legs, I'd kick you. And Die My Love with Jennifer Lawrence, yeah. and the upcoming
Sentimental Value with Renate, yeah.
The Testament of Anne Lee. With Amanda Seyfried.
It's coming up, yeah.
That's coming up. She's very
good.
She's
getting a lot of buzz, yeah.
For good reason, but it's like there's so many of these movies that are dealing with like either the loss of a child or postpartum in some way. I'm not against these things. I'm glad that there are more representation of the struggles that women go through with very real, mm-hmm. real forms of drama that reflect where we are in this world and why it's good to have access to things that can help them with that. There's a lot of it this year.
When it rains, it pours. You know what I mean? Like, again, we'll see a lot of that stuff as waves or as themes for any given year. So it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
But will things be as funny as giving your grandson Irreversible and the piano teacher? And telling, what was the line? Monica Bellucci line?
Monica Bellucci, damn it. That should be, I hope that's the clip they play in Stellan Skarsgård's Oscar.
For Stellan, for his supporting actor role.
Him just
giving the gifts.
Him just winking at his grandson and saying, Monica Bellucci.
If they did, I would just give him the Oscar.
I'd like to think that for some reason he has two guests, so it's Alexander and Bill.
He's not going to bring his wife.
His two giant sons poking him in the ribs.
That's right, yeah. Like, Bill Skarsgård.
Well, no, they'd just be at the Oscars, because Skarsgård's going to be there.
They're invited anyway. He's going to bring his youngest son, who's like...
Skarsgård still have a film. He has a film coming out, Alexander does. Pillion, or whatever, with him and Henry... What's his face? The Henry Big Ears from Harry Potter. What's his face?
That's right. Yeah. Henry
Melling. Henry Melling.
Henry
Melling. Henry Big Ears, you know.
Henry Big Ears, yeah. Right when you said that and also the Harry Potter.
You knew what I was talking about.
Yeah. No. Old blue eyes.
He's a great actor.
He's turned into a really good actor.
Have you seen that trailer, by the way, for that movie?
I'm trying to avoid it.
It's not going to ruin anything, but like it's,
you know how I am with trailers.
It's a really good trailer as far as I didn't know about this movie. Now I do. And I want to see it. So
coming out this year.
Yeah. They're waiting on it I guess because they have other 84 is a lot of stuff. So like they're trying to stage it, but I'm like, I want to see this badly. Damn it. Like, it looks great. Anyway, Hamnet.
Hamnet. I will say as my closing thought, I'd love to see Chloe Zhao. Kind of go back to some of her non-actor roles, which I find fascinating. You know, she's done that early in her career, two of them, twice. And again, a little bit in Nomadland 2. She's doing great work here with Actors for Real. But, like, you know, we talked about the Jean-Luc Godard stuff, just, like, letting art kind of come out. Again, I'm blown away by how she was able to make a movie like The Writer with the real people playing characters of themselves. And I was like, this is just fascinating stuff from Chloe.
What if she made Eternals again, but she recast it with all non-professional actors?
And they have real powers? I mean, that'd be amazing.
Like, she just went to Kevin Feige. He's like, look, I know...
This is...
I know the Eternals aren't the most popular characters, so what if we just recast all of them, except Camille?
Because he's very funny.
He's kept the body, we'll keep the guy.
He's supposed to sign up for like 6 pictures from what he said in interviews post. But I will say that this also speaks to finding new talent, you know what I mean? I'm just like, this is what was great back in like the 90s, 80s, 70s, whatever. It's like, you just found some guy who just, or some gal who just is a really good actor. And that's how I became really, really, really famous.
I mean, to a point, but I'm not against Chloe Zhao working with the best people working right now and giving him a great job, great work to do.
So. But I'm just saying, like, you know, the open casting is also like a really cool way to find people as well.
I know what you're saying. I don't disagree with you. I can appreciate that Chloe Zhao is in a position where she can go from making a Marvel blockbuster to being like, I want to make this small, intimate character drama about William Shakespeare's family. Yeah. Like,
I can't wait for Celine Song to make a Marvel movie.
it'd be the best
depressing movie
about Battle Web 2.
It's got to have a throuple situation.
Get Dakota back in there from Adam Web 2.
Who knows?
After she appears in Secret Wars, I assume we'll see where things go.
I love the assertive "I assume."
Yeah, as it's bound to happen.
That would mean that Uncle Ben's back too.
Hamnet is currently playing in limited release. It's going to spread wider. Well, it's spread wider this weekend. Mm-hmm. It's going to spread somewhat wider. Regardless, it's in theaters. It's coming to more theaters as it goes along, as these awards contender films generally do. Abe, when do people see Hamnet?
I enjoyed it. I would say theaters.
I wouldn't say stream it. I would say like when you get that when it's January and you get that like, hey, come see the award contenders at a discount price, then you can go see Hamnet. I think that's the appropriate way.
The award contenders at this like a 3-for-5 deal?
When they start doing like the, especially when it's close to the Oscars, which is more I guess March, February, when they're like, yeah, you can see all the Academy Award nominated films at like a lower price or whatever.
Yeah.
That's where my recommendation lies when it comes to Hamnet. All right, we've done it. We've talked about another threesome of films.
Yes.
Yes.
That's how we rephrase
not
it.
Not a lot, just say yes and.
Yes and. You're right. We did talk about a threesome.
Yeah. And this was fun.
I'm a bad improv partner. I apologize.
You let your face do too much work. I was like, you should have just
immediately jumped on and kept going with
it. You got to respond to this. Yeah. There's still plenty of films that we are out, that are around, that we'd like to spend some time on. So we'll see if we're able to pull off another one of these in the near future. But otherwise, we do have Jay Kelly coming up as our next main review, which should be a lot of fun to talk about. But with all that said, that's going to do it for this bonus episode about Now With Her Name. You can find everything I do on my personal Substack page, codazeet.com. Fun thing, on the other podcast I co-host with Terrence Johnson, friend of this show, fellow film critic, Two Black Guys Talk Godzilla, the award-winning podcast. This week we released our audio from our LA Comic-Con panel appearance.
That's right.
If you want to hear our live show in front of a packed audience, that's the latest episode up for Two Black Guys Talk Godzilla. And I'm on all the socials there. It's PS4. Abe?
From our friends over on Instagram, Abe.Mua, and Twitter.com, Blue Sky, hashtag Walrus Moose, hashtag ICBMs. That's appropriate, right?
Yes, yeah.
Don't actually hashtag that.
Don't worry.
We're going to get flagged by...
I wasn't going to. this podcast is going to be everywhere we can find podcasts.
Yeah, we're online.
Find us at all the sites you can find shows on, but please give us a rating or review if you like have the chance to as well. That'd be wonderful. And like I said, Jay Kelly is our next main review, so stay tuned for that. But that's going to do it for this week. Thanks, you listeners, for listening to this bonus show. Until next time, so long.
And goodbye.
For your tenable talent and ambitions are low, and his center was right. Missions hung good, and a sense of rights take a difference. road.